The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
This is a truly transformative event on the global scene. Namely, that for the first time in human history, for the first time in all of human history, almost all of mankind is politically awake, activated, politically conscious, and interactive. There are only a few pockets of humanity, here or there, in the remotest corners of the world, which are not politically alert and interactive with the political turmoil and stirrings and aspirations around the world. And all of that is creating a worldwide surge in the quest for personal dignity and cultural respect in a diversified world, sadly accustomed for many centuries to domination by one portion of the world of another. That is an enormous change. And these new and old major powers face still yet another novel reality, in some respects unprecedented. And it is that while the lethality of their power is greater than ever, their capacity to impose control over the politically awakened masses of the world is at a historical low. I once put it rather pungently, and I was flattered that the British Foreign Secretary repeated this, as follows. Namely, in earlier times, it was easier to control a million people, literally. It was easier to control a million people than physically to kill a million people. Today, it is infinitely easier to kill a million people than to control a million people. It is easier to kill than to control.
To another episode of Thought Crime Radio. That was Zbigniew Brzezinski speaking at Chatham House in 2008, demonstrating what the ruling powers of the world, the Western world, concern themselves thinking about. Given 9/11, I would say that at least this society is still largely controllable. However, the veil is dropping away from the powers behind the throne, the Wizard of Oz, the money changers, the covert machinations that go on, that seem to be hell-bent on destroying the economic and social and political infrastructure of this country. They're being exposed, and As a result, I think it's not surprising that you can frequently see these mysterious contrails going by overhead. I suppose that's a conspiracy theory. Our eyes must be lying to us somehow. I'm sure these contrails don't really exist. It's just paranoid to question what our great leaders have in store for us. But anyway, I thought Brzezinski's speech was unusually candid, and I thought I should play that. One of the dominant themes of this show has been the exposure of the principle of the shock doctrine and its applications in many different domains, ranging from the so-called financial crisis to the so-called war on drugs to the so-called war on terror to so-called medicine and nutrition. The economic opportunities are endless. So what do I mean by the shock doctrine? It's very simple, really. The creation of a problem in order to profit from the remedy to it. There's a humorous illustration of the technique on YouTube where the Three Stooges are seen introducing mice, ants, and moths into a mansion during a socialite party and then posing as pest exterminators. The name of the skit is Ants in the Pantry, and it ought to be shown in our grade schools to educate children about how the world really works. Unfortunately, our lack of such basic education is reflected in the reluctance of grown-ups to face less humorous realities in the public sphere, where criminal cartels and secretive networks of intergenerationally self-replicating psychopaths have infested virtually every conceivable niche of our economic, defense, law enforcement, and medical infrastructures, exploiting the trust and good intentions of millions of public servants and doctors in the process. CBS recently did an expose of a particularly offensive illustration of the principle in operation. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the federal agency which is purportedly in charge of enforcing federal gun laws, has been standing by and watching while Mexican criminal gangs ship thousands of weapons, including 50 caliber rifles and machine guns, from the U.S. into Mexico, where the weapons have been used to commit numerous murders, including at least one murder of a U.S. Border Control agent. All of this with the blessings of the so-called Department of Justice. And I will put links on thoughtcrimeradio.net showing this CBS News story. But this appears to be part of a larger ATF policy of refusing to shut down illicit gun trafficking all over the country. The more obvious payoff, of course, is that the ATF can use the resulting criminal activity to lobby for more U.S. tax dollars to protect us from the consequences of their negligence. A kind of backhanded protection racket.
Hey, we really want to help you out, but to be safe in the neighborhood, but, it's really hard. Business is booming, if you know what I mean.
Variations on this theme can be seen in the war on drugs and, of course, in the Wall Street gamblers' bailout. In a larger context, of course, all this federal corruption is being used in a concerted propaganda campaign against the Second Amendment to the Constitution, which the founders wrote into the Bill of Rights so that we the people might be secure in our own homes and be able to protect ourselves from precisely this kind of predatory government. You can draw your own conclusions about the existence of a larger agenda here, especially in light of the massive inflation, poverty, and taxation which Wall Street and the so-called Federal Reserve have so carefully engineered for us. The coming meltdown amounts to a gullibility test for the American people and the good people who serve in government. Will they be able and willing to connect the dots and see the traitors and scam artists for what they are? Speaking of gullibility, I have a quick test for you. Suppose you stub your toe and it hurts, so you go to the doctor. But the doctor doesn't look at your toe, he looks at your brain instead. He puts your head in an MRI and does all kinds of expensive tests to determine whether you might have disordered thoughts about that particular toe, which could be comorbid with a reluctance to trust your doctor, both of which are often precursors to a deeper brain pathology involving complicated-sounding chemicals and neural structures that reach out like tentacles from your reptilian brain, all because you had the misfortune of coming from a bad gene pool. As he reaches for a shiny new chrome-plated sterile Craftsman screwdriver in preparation for a preemptive lobotomy, one of the few procedures covered under your healthcare plan, he suddenly called to the phone and disappears for a few minutes. Do you A, thank your lucky stars they caught it in time, B, wonder whether a quick head bottomy might be more effective, or C, hobble out the back door as fast as you can? Now make the following substitutions in the above scenario. Instead of having a broken toe, you're a foster child. You came from a broken home. Instead of physical pain, you suffer from emotional pain. And instead of reaching for a chrome-plated Craftsman screwdriver, the doctor attaches two shiny, brand-new, sterile electrodes to your head and prepares to plug them into a very expensive-looking chrome-plated electric wall outlet. Does your gullibility quotient win out over your intelligence quotient? So, on the phone with us today, we have John Breeding, a clinical psychologist and counselor from Austin, Texas, who has just returned from what he calls a battle in Gaithersburg, an FDA hearing on a proposal to reclassify psychiatry's electroshock machines as being safe and effective without the peer-reviewed scientific studies which would otherwise be required of their manufacturers. Believe it or not, after decades of use on hundreds of thousands of people, mainly women and children, the FDA was considering whether such an approval process ought to be undertaken at all. So, John, are you there? John, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, hallelujah. We dropped the connection, but you're back. This is good.
Yeah, it was breaking up really bad. I don't know what happened on that other line, so I called you on this.
Okay,
on this number.
Thank you, okay. And Patricia, are you there?
Me too, yeah, same thing.
All right, hallelujah.
I hung up and then called back.
Okay, so I guess you probably didn't hear that lead-in, but basically I introduced you, John, and the basic issues surrounding this FDA hearing into electroshock machines. So can you just go over a little bit of the history of how it was that these dangerous, basically transformers that output house current into the human brain, how they were allowed onto the market and kept on the market long past any reasonable time limit for scientific studies into the
right.
Their safety and efficacy?
Well, electroshock was invented in 1938, at least the modern form of it, by Ugo Cerletti in Italy. He was really wanting to use electricity on human beings, and he observed finally that in a slaughterhouse in Italy, they were using electroshock to stun the hogs before they slaughtered them, and by doing that to the head, it knocked them out, but it didn't kill them. And he had been killing the animals in his experiments and stuff, and he was sending the electricity through the body and through the chest cavity, and so it was killing people. And so then he said, oh, you could do it by just doing it directly to the head. And so they picked up a vagrant off the streets and shocked him, and that was the beginning of electroshock. And it gravitated really within a couple of years to the United States in 1940 and started up here. And so they were using it a lot in the 40s and 50s and on into the early 60s in the wards of the state hospitals as a ward management technique, basically to control and subdue patients. But once the Thorazine and stuff came on in the 50s and stuff, and they gradually didn't need that as much, and plus it became controversial because of all the damage that it was doing, but it continued, and even though it really started going on the outs as its sister treatments, which were lobotomy and insulin coma shock, both were gradually abandoned and outlawed during that time, but electroshock kind of hung on. And then starting in the 70s, really, and then especially in the 80s and on up to today, there was a big push by the electroshock industry and the psychiatric industry to basically do a huge public relations campaign to try to get electroshock going again, and they were successful. What happened was in the mid-70s, the FDA was put in regulatory oversight of medical devices, and this included electroshock machines. And so those machines, those devices that weren't really tested and proven safe were put automatically in class three, which means dangerous and experimental. And what they're supposed to do when they're in that category is they're supposed to do what's called a PMA, which is pre-market approval, which basically means that they do some serious controlled studies with all the classic, you know, double-blind studies and, you know, significant outcomes and all that, and see if these things are really, one, safe, and two, effective. And if they're not, then they're taken off the market. But some of the devices were so-called grandfathered in, which means that they were allowed to continue in the meantime. And then, so then if you look at the history from 1976 on, and it's best laid out in Linda Andre's book, which is called Doctors of Deception, What They Don't Want You to Know About Electroshock. That's the best book on the subject. You'll see that what's happened is that the FDA has repeatedly bent over backwards to avoid holding the shock industry accountable, as they have systematically and repeatedly avoided providing the evidence that would justify continuing these machines. They've just been allowed to continue. And so then fast forward all the way up to January 2011 in Gaithersburg up near Washington, D.C., the FDA once again is feeling some political pressure to confront these class three dangerous experimental devices, you know, and either put up or shut up, that they either be moved to class two, which means they're relatively safe and effective, or they'd be taken off the market. That's what led to the hearings in January, and that's how we got here.
And what types of, demographically, what types of people tend to be subjected to this treatment?
Well, percentage-wise, you know, it's a huge feminist issue, a huge women's issue, because women get more than men, and elderly women get more than anybody. The most popular population in general is nowadays, it used to be just elderly women straight up, you know, we were the ones who predominantly got shocked. Now it's so-called paramenopausal, you know, the period around menopause, you know, so that age, but still women getting proportionally more electroshock than men. It's people who are called, now it used to be fairly indiscriminate, you know, it still is sometimes, unfortunately, but predominantly it's for a diagnosis of so-called depression. Predominantly it's people who've been on a whole bunch of various cocktails of pharmacological psychotropic substances and have just gotten worse, more depressed, deteriorated in some way or another, and finally it comes in and says, well, it's called treatment-resistant depression, in quotes, and then you bring in the electroshock, and that's what we're seeing nowadays. We're also seeing still a significant amount of forced electroshock, court-ordered electroshock. New York is an epicenter of that, but it really happens all over the country. They've even started trying to court-order outpatient electroshock. There's been a couple of dramatic cases in Minnesota that have been in the press a lot the last few years. One right now, in fact, a woman named Elizabeth Ellis who's court-ordered to receive electroshock, even though she doesn't want it, her husband doesn't want her to have it. She's very coherent and articulate about why she doesn't want it, and yet it's like once that road is started, you know, the industry and the courts just push, and so that's how draconian it is. That's how much violations of human rights are involved.
Where do children fit in? I mean, how often?
Yeah, so you get so the biggest demographic is, you know, women and older women. But the reality is that you get a whole spectrum across all social classes, because you can get it publicly or privately. You can also get Medicaid or Medicare payment, but also children, You know, internationally, you know, we've seen data on a lot of kids in Australia, for example, getting electroshock. But also, it's happening in the United States. Texas, where I'm from, is one of the few places in the world that bans electroshock in children. One of the things that you see argued for nowadays is the idea that maybe autistic children should be electroshocked, which is just, it just makes me shiver. But you do see still young people getting electroshocked at times.
So one of the primary backgrounds of people who wind up in the mental health system, especially young people, it tends to be that they come from dysfunctional homes, right? Child abuse, emotional abuse, poverty, things like that.
When I first started getting involved specifically in challenging electroshock, which would have been, you know, 20 years or so ago, I had a friend who had been a nurse at Seton Shoal Creek Hospital, which is, if you go to our endofshock.com website, which is a really good website for information on shock from our Coalition for the Abolition of Electroshock in Texas, that's endofshock.com, you'll see some information about our specific campaign to challenge electroshock here in Austin, Texas, and especially at Seton Shoal Creek Hospital. And she had worked there, and she would see these young people, adolescent age, young adult age, especially girls, young women that were getting shocked. And even before she really knew or understood what was going on, you know, she would always think, you know, what do they not want that young person to remember? What do they not want them to talk about? Because one thing that definitely happens, and you know, is that electroshock causes brain damage, it causes memory loss, causes profound memory loss, and it causes a hell of a lot of terror and fear, and it's very brutalizing and intimidating kind of process, very frightening kind of process, and so,
even,
you know, people literally forget, or they become passive and apathetic, or just so intimidated they're not going to talk about the things that are really hard to talk about. And, I mean, we know that, you know, I mean, there's multi-causal dynamics involved when you've got either turbulence or, you know, troubled and troubling behavior, you know, whether it's really troubled individuals, you know, which happens, or whether it's troubling situations in which people are upset with somebody and don't like how they're acting and want them brought into line, you know. Either way, you know, you've got stuff going on, and sometimes it's physical, you know, so you have physical dynamics going on where you've got, you know, blood sugar problems or thyroid problems or other kind of physical problems that can cause so-called psychiatric symptomatology. But a lot of times, sometimes you just have conflict, family conflict and stuff like that. But sometimes you have distress, you know, that's a result of trauma and emotional or psychological trauma. It's not uncommon, and that can definitely cause depression and anxiety and things that we call that. And there's called communication and listening and emotional healing and things like that. And then there's called just deciding, and I did hear just a little bit of when you were talking about having a problem with your toe and going into your brain, but it's like, you know, you just decide that these things are due to chemical imbalance or brain disease, and then you've got a carte blanche to throw out the drugs and with the backup treatment. Electroshock.
There is no science behind. I mean, they have no evidence for this assumption that there's something wrong with these people's brains, right?
It's an incontrovertible fact that no problem routinely seen by psychiatry has been scientifically demonstrated to be of biological or genetic origin. That's a astounding statement, you know, given all the propaganda that you hear, but But the chemical imbalance theory is just a theory, and the brain disease theory is just a theory. And every time that it's really looked at closely, it doesn't hold up, you know. And proof is in the pudding. There is no objective test or indicator for any routine psychiatric diagnosis, you know, whether it's ADHD, attention deficit so-called disorder, or whether it's so-called clinical depression, or whether it's so-called bipolar, or any of those things, you know. They're just words that are put on somebody's description of somebody's behavior, and then there's an assumption that's brought in that says it's a biological or genetic problem. It's pseudoscience, totally.
It's
really a modern day form of eugenics, in the sense that it's saying that problems in living, you know, in people who are judged as having problems or considered unacceptable or abnormal or whatever, is due to some sort of biological or genetic defect, you know, which is a continuation of the basic dynamic of the Nazis, you know, which said that, you know, inferior peoples, you know, due to inferior germplasm, you know, due to life unworthy of living due to biological and genetic inferiority. This is really saying the same thing. We're not putting people in gas chambers, but it really is a pharmacost. And when you look at the fact that people who get caught up long-term in psychiatry, you know, with all these drugs, die on average 25 years younger than the general population. Electroshock specifically sometimes causes death. I mean, you know, that's one...
It causes suicide, right? I mean, when you wipe out a person's memories, you're wiping out their emotional bridges to their social support network. This is a...
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the tragic ironies of the deal is that one of the things that is used to justify electroshock is that we need extreme measures because these people are... Because people are suicidal and this can, you know... But the data is very clear. When you look at the research, it does not prevent or ameliorate suicide. You know, it just doesn't. And specifically in individual cases, you see exactly what you're talking about, Rich, you know, which is that, I mean, the famous case is Ernest Hemingway, the renowned American author, you know, who after his second round of electroshock at the prestigious Mayo Clinic told his friend, you know, he said, it's a bum turn, Hotch, you know. What good is a writer's, I'm paraphrasing here, but what good is a writer's life, you know, if you destroy his memory?
Yeah, and then he kills
and then
him.
And then a week later after he was discharged, he blew his brains out with a shotgun.
Yeah, I mean, this is not rocket science. You know, social support networks are critical for anyone's happiness, and you basically isolate them on a ward, you pathologize their feelings, you second guess their own self perception of their historical background, and you blame it all on their brain, and then you damage their brains and wipe out their memories of their loved ones. This is the unbelievable amount of cruelty involved here. I remember reading an article several years ago where they were actually using shock treatment against gay teenagers to try to reprogram them to be normal, so to speak.
So yeah, that's true.
This is a high-tech form of blaming the victim. And getting back to eugenics, I have a short segment here from Alex Jones' Endgame film. You're probably familiar with the testimony before the Texas legislature by this shrink, psychiatrist, whatever.
Yeah, I was there.
I
turned Alex on to that clip, as a matter of fact, that Dr. Joe Burkett from Fort Worth.
Yeah, so I'm going to play this. It's a short segment, and it really gives an insight into the mind processes, the brain processes of these individuals who call themselves doctors.
In the case of foster children, a sector where the state has total control, at least two-thirds are forced to take a cocktail made up of, on average, seven psychotropic drugs. Chairman of the Texas Society of Psychiatric Physicians, Joe Burkett, testified before the State House Select Committee hearing on psychotropic drugs in foster care and shocked the public when he said that two-thirds of foster children in Texas have been placed on psychiatric drugs because they were very, very sick from a bad gene pool.
A lot of these kids come from bad gene pools. They don't have stable parents making good decisions. Besides the gene pools, they've then been traumatized by abuse, neglect, and problems, and then they've been traumatized by separation, and all those things predispose to mental illness.
Yeah, he does this hand-waving homage to social environment and psychology, but obviously his main target there is the physical brain. And I guess psychiatrists don't use their brains very much. Maybe they don't think they're that important, but a lot of people do value the neurological integrity of their personalities and memories. Patricia, are you still?
Yeah, most people who testify stuff like that are a little more careful about what they say. But what Burkett said was very much an accurate statement of what they actually think in the basis of their actual behavior, which is that it is about genetic, biological and genetic defect. I mean, that's what totally justifies what these guys do, which is, and all that they do, which is prescribe drugs, with the backup treatment being electroshock. I mean, that's all that guy does, and that's all that 99% of the psychiatric profession does anymore, is prescribe drugs. And regrettably, that whole mindset and justification has spilled over to the medical profession at large. You know, since psychiatrists only prescribe about 10% of psych drugs, you know, that means 90% of it is from doctors who are general practitioners, family doctors, obstetricians, internal medicine doctors, oncologists, you name it. You know, I mean, it's really a shame and a disgrace that all these folks just pass out these psych drugs as soon as somebody says they're anxious or depressed or whatever. You know, they get a sleeping drug or a downer tranquilizer or a amphetamine type speed, or, you know, because basically the drug categories are pretty simple. They're basically uppers and downers, you know, but they come in all these different packages and colors, you know, so they can inundate and sell on the market. But yeah, it's a lie. It's pseudoscience. It's propaganda. You know, what Linda Andre's book is so great about Doctors of Deception and talking about electroshock is that it just lays out the unfortunate fact that there's been a victory of public relations over science. The science is clear in the sense that electroshock causes brain damage, it causes memory loss, it does not work, and it sometimes kills. The propaganda is so effective that they're allowed to continue. Robert Whittaker does the same thing in his great 2010 book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, about the drugs, in terms of laying out the difference between the propaganda campaign of the industry and what the actual science says, you know, about the drugs specifically, you know, in the different categories. You know, the actual science says they cause all these problems, they have all these damaging effects. You're less likely to actually get better the longer you take the drug, you know, and they don't work, you know. And so he lays it out with the drug, she lays it out with the shock, you know. So the important thing is to be willing to take a little time to do a little research and actually find out the data. And then, you know, it's like Bob Marley, you know, none but ourselves can free our minds. You know, we've been colonized with this propaganda that says, you know, when you've got a emotional dynamic or a problem in living or whatever, you know, that means chemical imbalance, brain disease. But it's all propaganda in order to justify a certain corporate and professional and governmental intrusion into people's lives. You know, that thing that you said about blaming the victims, Rich, is really right on, in the sense that really it's a classic mechanism of oppression. And I know you've written about this, and I have too. You know, it's like, I call it psychiatric oppression, but it's basically that you absolve society of responsibility for really looking at issues of social and economic justice, for really looking at people's lives and what might support their lives and well-beings. And instead, you know, just blaming the victims. In this case, blaming them and saying that they're genetically and biologically defective. And so, you know, we have 15, 18 million children in this country on various psychotropic drugs, you know, and instead of institutionalized child abuse and a shame and a disgrace, you know, to turn our young children into a profit point for Eli Lilly and Ciba Geigy and all these drug companies, you know, instead of confronting that, you know, it's called, oh, we've got all these medically sick, mentally ill children who need their medicine. It's a huge cover-up, and it's terrible.
Patricia, are you there?
Yeah, I just... You know, from where I'm sitting, I was thinking, this somehow reminds me of the witch hunts centuries ago, you know, when they just would name call and blame and shame and guilt and marginalize people, you know, who were different or thought that they were different or something, and then punished them for that, you know, whereas actually the people might be just your... regular nonconformist or wise person, even, you know, someone who knew.
I wrote an essay. That's right. I wrote an essay this year in honor of Thomas. It's published in the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, but it's in honor of Thomas Zotz, who's one of my main mentors. And one of his most famous books, or I don't know if it's his most famous book, but it's one of most famous in my mind anyway, is called The Manufacture of Madness, and the subtitle is A Comparative Study of the Inquisition and the Mental Health Movement. And his analogy is just exactly what you're talking about. It's the Inquisition is to heresy, as psychiatry is to mental illness. And he just lays it out, you know, but it's the same dynamic of social control. You know, as the church was replaced by science as a major dynamic of kind of controlling society, you get, instead of the inquisitors punishing heretics who were threats to the social order and the social power structure, in this case witches, for example, you know, instead of that, you can just designate somebody as mentally ill, make them a scapegoat, and exert social control in places where they go beyond the scope of the criminal justice system, and totally violate and abrogate every kind of human right or civil right you ever had, you know. I mean, I heard the statistic is of, we've been talking about electroshock and children and things like that, but there's about 1.5 million adult Americans every year in this country who are incarcerated and forcibly poisoned against their will, you know, with no criminality involved. So it's called civil commitment, involuntary commitment, and forced medication, drugging. You know, basically it's called incarceration, psychiatric incarceration, and forced injection with poisonous, toxic psychiatric drugs based on somebody's judgment in a court order that a person is mentally ill with basically no due process. I mean, they have these mental health courts, which are basically kind of kangaroo courts where you just have to have, you know, doctors who say the person is mentally ill and a judge is willing to kind of stamp it. And it's, I mean, you know, we're a lot of us are in outcry about, you know, these abrogation of civil rights around, you know, the Patriot Act and the so-called war on terror, and we very well should be. But people need to also realize that the numbers are even so far greater, you know, in these human rights and civil rights abuses around detention and enforced poisoning of people who are judged and adjudicated as mentally ill.
I have to do a station break, and when we get back, I want to go something, you know, somewhat into the science. When you say that this causes brain damage and so on, let's just get into some of the studies that have been done. And
okay,
we will be right back.
Some of the funds for this program are provided by listener support and a donation from the Columbia Housing Authority. The Columbia Housing Authority provides affordable housing options and services that help youth succeed in school and life, promote family self-sufficiency, and enable seniors and persons with disabilities to live life independently. Located at 201 Switzer Street, the Columbia Housing Authority can be contacted at 573-443-2556.
This program brought to you by listener support and a donation from Mojo's. Coming to Mojo's on Friday, March 25th, the country sounds of James McMurtry, along with special appearance from the Bottle Rockets.
Got a little house, I'm paying on it still.
That's James McMurtry and the Bottle Rockets at Mojo's Friday, March 25th. Doors at 7:30 p.m. More information available at 875-0588 or at mojoscolumbia.com.
Every day.
I know what you're going through.
I've been there.
Nobody else I know has been there.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan. I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Things at home may be as you left them.
But you don't feel the same.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
And connect to others who are going through the same thing.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is BJ Allen with Blue Voodoo, and you're listening to Blues on Broadway right here on 89.5 KOPN.
Okay, I guess I chose the wrong PSA there. This is not Blues on Broadway. This is Thought Crime Radio, but Blues on Broadway is certainly a good program, which is on at another time. Okay, so... So I guess I had a brain defect, huh? Maybe I should get a little micro lobotomy. I'm sure that I can be helped. So let's go into some of the animal studies that have been done, for instance. These things have been done. I mean, people need to understand that just like obstetrical abuse and circumcision, the research into the quackery involving this particular procedure is longstanding and repeatedly confirmed. And in fact, in the psychiatric journals, you will find people like Max Planck, who is an outspoken proponent of shock treatment, compare it to closed head injury and talking about the beneficial effects of brain damage. And actually, Max Planck was at least at one time, and he may still be a lead researcher in the CIA's MK Ultra project. So you get an idea of the ethics and morality of some of these people.
Well, when electroshock first came on the scene in the 40s and then on into the 50s and 60s, shock doctors were quite forthcoming about the fact that it was brain damaging, you know, because from their perspective, the damage was the effect, you know. There was the argument that, you know, mentally ill people really had too much brain power and you needed to disable and damage the brain to some extent to bring them, you know, back to a calmer, more sedate, more controlled kind of life. And so, you know, it was in the same category as lobotomy, you know, which obviously was deliberately brain damaging and as well as insulin coma shock. And so these guys would overtly acknowledge, you know, and then at some point, really in the 60s, and then with you know, the revelation of these snake pit, to quote the book title, the hospitals, the revelations of how awful it was in the backwards of these state hospitals, together with the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when that came out, you know, psychiatry and electroshock got a bad rep, you know, deservedly, and so when they had to kind of try to make a comeback and repackage themselves, you know, it was very much a public relations thing, and it was not acceptable to talk about, you know, deliberately damaging the brain as a form of medical treatment. But yeah, they were very overt about it, and back in those days, you also had studies, you know, they did animal studies and some human autopsies, and the evidence of brain damage was pretty clear. You know, in the 40 years since then, you know, you don't see those kind of studies. They've deliberately avoided them. But, you know, when you think about the brain damage, when you think about it, it's pretty obvious, you know, that if you send literally hundreds of volts of electricity directly into the brain, which normally operates in millivolts, which is thousands of volts, you know, you're going to cause damage. I mean, it's pretty obvious that when the rest of medicine, you know, deliberately avoids electrical shocking people because it's damaging, deliberately avoids causing seizures because they're damaging, you know, then something doesn't line up. You know, you're going to have direct heat and electrical damage is going to cause cell death. You know, you're going to have cells literally exploding, neurons exploding. You know, you're going to have cell death that way. You're going to have a breaching of the blood-brain barrier, which is this hugely protective dynamic, you know, so that the blood and the rest of the body can do its things and sort of processing and purifying and clearing, and if the brain tissue is protected from this process. Instead, you breach that, and so you leach toxins and materials in the brain that are not to be meant to be in the brain, and that causes damage. You also induce a grand mal convulsion, which creates this excitotoxicity, and you get all kinds of glutamate and other overactivity in the brain, and this is why people take drugs or do things specifically to suppress seizures if they're epileptic, because they're known to be damaging and cumulatively damaging. So there's many ways in which cell death and brain damage is caused by electroshock. The animal studies showed it. You know, there were human studies back in the day that showed it. Nowadays, the way that you know there's brain damage, mainly since they've avoided the studies that really look at the brain, is that the main indicator of brain damage to any neurologist worth his salt is memory loss. And electroshock always causes memory loss, and often very, very profound. And this is an indicator of brain damage. And so those are some of the ways that you see brain damage and you see memory loss. It's very, very profound. At the FDA hearings in Washington, D.C. in January, you know, it was very troubling to listen to these guys, but it was interesting. And ultimately, it was good that they couldn't get around the fact that memory loss was a constant and pervasive effect of electroshock, and they just couldn't get around it. The 8 psychiatrist industry people on the panel could get around it. There was 5 psychiatrists, several of them, some of them who did shock, others who referred to electroshock. There was a device industry guy. There was a pharmacologist person, and there was an anesthesiologist who was really another industry person, because every time somebody gets electroshock, if you get 2 or 3 a week, you know, you have anesthesia every time, so the anesthesia profession is also involved in the industry. Those 8 people all voted and wanted very badly for the electroshock machines to be reclassified as safe and effective, class 2. The other 10 people on the panel unanimously, and these were neurologists, psychologists, biostatisticians, there was a patient representative, you know, a whole spectrum of people. All 10 of those people were clear that these machines should remain class 3. So that was really interesting. They couldn't get around the memory loss, and they couldn't get around the fact that there wasn't really evidence that the things worked.
In trying to anticipate some of the rejoinders that could be expected from psychiatrists about some of the things we've been covering here, the convulsions issue, you know, that they use muscle relaxants now so that the body doesn't physically react to what's going on in the brain, but that has no effect on what's happening in the brain, is that correct?
So the argument, and this is part of the repackaging, is that we have a newer, safer electroshock. And they want to say that it's safer because they use a different sine wave or pulse wave frequency, or that they want to, or that they do unilateral as opposed to bilateral, meaning one temple as opposed to both, which isn't true in general practice. But they talk about these things, you know. But the reality is that if anything, it's more dangerous because in general, more electricity is actually used with these new machines. Doug Cameron did an article on this. It's laid out on our endofshock.com website. But what's really different is like what you're saying, Rich, which is that in the old days, you'd see broken bones, a lot of broken teeth. You still see the teeth problems sometimes nowadays, but not as much. But you see, because people were electroshocked without anesthesia and without muscle relaxants, so you had these convulsions that were just wild and strong and very damaging physically as well as to the brain. And so now people are under heavy general anesthesia and given muscle relaxants, and so you don't see that much movement, you know. But the damage is in the brain, and so it's the amount of electricity in the brain and the storm of activity that's still going on in the brain that causes the different types of damage and cell death that I've been talking about. And so it's a soundbite, the newer, safer electroshock. The truth is, it's at least as dangerous than ever, except for the broken bones and broken teeth. But then you've got an extra danger that wasn't present then, which is that how safe is it to be getting general anesthesia three times a week, you know, for many weeks, you know? What are the complications and dangers of that, you know? Most people can relate to the fact that general anesthesia is a serious thing, and multiple general anesthesias is a very serious and troubling dynamic.
How much is it actually happening in the United States?
Well, the estimate that's thrown around all the time is about 100,000 people a year get electroshocked. Around the world, it's a lot more. What we know is, you know, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry worldwide. You know, what we know is that a series of electroshock treatments, you know, might run about $15,000, and oftentimes people get multiple series. It's hard to track the exact numbers because there's very few states that have reporting laws. Texas is one of the very few, along with California and I think Vermont. So it's hard to track the data, but that's probably in the ballpark.
And in one of your videos, you referred to it as torture, which is what Rich and I point to about circumcision. And the other thing that you just mentioned is that it's big business, and that there are always industries involved, you know, who are actually making the equipment and selling the equipment. And so they're very interested in their corporation staying alive. So they lobby the legislators and try to get laws that make it okay for them to torture us in different ways, you know. So
yeah, I mean, part of the whole dynamic of oppression, you know, as it plays out, is this interface between, you know, and nowadays, certainly in our country, it's true, this interface between, you know, private industry and corporations and government at both the legislative level as well as the judicial level as well as the regulatory level. So, you know, so you've got Congress, you know, heavily lobbied and paid for, you know, by the industry. You've got the FDA, basically a lapdog to the industry and a revolving door. You know, you've got the judicial branch.
Did you say a lapdog?
Lap dog.
Lap dog.
The FDA is a lap dog to Big Pharma. Government in general really is a lap dog to Big Pharma.
They're servants to big business.
Yeah. Because that's where the money flows come from.
Yeah.
It's terrible. And so in the case of psychiatry, you've got, you know, the laws in place that allow and justify all these actions. You know, you've got a certain amount of funding sources. You've got the regulatory agencies that you know, don't provide any kind of protection for the public, but basically, you know, put up kind of a facade of that, and then do the industry's bidding. And this is why electroshock industry has gotten shined on in spite of deliberately avoiding providing the research that they're supposed to show to justify the machines. And then you've got the courts, you know, that rubber stamp the process, and so that's how it works. I think I'm leaving somebody out, but you get the idea.
So what happened at the hearing that you went to, only that the device was not upgraded to a safe device? Is that the only thing that happened?
Well, the psychiatrists on the and industry people on the panel, you know, were just really, 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 you know, wanted these things reclassified to Schedule II. You know, they really tried to sell how effective they were and how clinically important they were and how relatively safe they were and how horrible these mental illnesses were and how they desperately needed every tool they could possibly have to help all these so sick people, you know. And of course the tools were are only two, the drugs and electroshock. But the rest of the folks didn't buy it, you know. There was a and so we were very happy that there was at least 10 non-industry people on the panel and that we got 100% of them on the main votes. The one weak point due to a sort of a kind of like your brain glitch or whatever, you know, there was a character glitch in the patient rep on the panel, Karis, who was so good, you know, but when it came around for the vote, because they voted on six different diagnoses, you know, schizophrenia, depression, bipolar, like that, you know, and the kids said class three, you know, they haven't demonstrated safety and effectiveness, they need to be kept in class three. And then they got to the last one, which was so-called catatonia, whatever that is, I guess that means you don't move and don't talk. They were just really saying, oh, it's such a terrible thing, these people are so sick and so desperate and they're going to die if we don't do something for them, you know. So anyway, one or two people switched their vote and said, well, maybe that one could be saved, removed to class two, so I don't know what's going to be the effect of that, but overall it was a victory for us in the sense that I think the industry really, really expected that their PR campaign had been so effective that they were going to win the day. But there was enough testimony and enough political pressure that those people on the panel who weren't totally already involved in the industry just couldn't do it, couldn't go along with it.
So,
John, we've been talking about this problem of electroconvulsive shock therapy, ECT, and what occurred to me was maybe we should talk about solutions to mental problems, mental health problems. And so I wrote down, to remind myself, EFT, which is emotional freedom technique. So what can you tell us about that in 1 minute?
I like it. I like, you know, of course, Leonard calls my friend Leonard Frank calls electro ECT instead of electroconvulsive therapy. He calls it electroconvulsive torture, you know, or electroconvulsive brainwashing. So language is a very, very important dynamic. So I like emotional freedom, you know. I think the whole idea of liberation from oppression, you know, is about freedom and liberty, you know, freedom of, and that includes freedom of mind and freedom of consciousness. You know, one of the activist groups that I'm involved with is called Mind Freedom. You know, mindfreedom.org is a website, but it's a great coalition of survivors and activists around this issue of so-called mental health liberation or whatever you want to call it. And so freedom of consciousness, freedom of mind, and that's exactly what is robbed and deprived.
Freedom from mental illness, too. Freedom from mental illness and from emotional problems. That's what it's the freedom from, is EFT. It helps people who have problems like that so they don't need drugs or they don't need electroconvulsive therapy, shock therapy.
Well, people have problems for sure, but people don't have mental illness. You know, mental illness is a concept that was developed to justify what we're talking about, you know.
Right.
There's physical illness, there's mental